Okay, good afternoon, everyone. You can all hear me. As you can probably hear, I'm also Australian, not native Norwegian. That has advantages for me, but sometimes disadvantages for you, in that I, after a while, can start talking very fast and without opening my mouth. I sometimes forget there are not so many insects here as back home. It's a lovely day outside, and as Dag Elgesum said in his introduction, this event is somewhat of a contest between privacy and data protection concerns on the one hand and the concerns of light radiation on the other. Looks like we've lost, unfortunately, but it's nice to see that there is a core of concern here in Bergen, at least amongst some students and academics. The numbers turning up today are not, in my opinion, very reflective of the current state of debate generally in Norway. And I say this particularly for the benefit of our foreign guests, because the debate about the Data Retention Directive has been, I think, quite historic in terms of engaging numbers of people, in stimulating them to sign up to different sorts of campaigns and opprop, etc., etc. I was engaged by Aftenposten a couple of months ago to engage in a type of netprat, and I was just overwhelmed by the number of questions and statements made by people. And this is an issue that seems to be, at least, of great concern, in theory, at least, to a lot of people in Norway. And that's I say it's historic because generally privacy concerns don't engage us. We might say in response to a particular survey, yes, we think privacy is very important, yes, we think it should be protected, but when it comes down to everyday choices, very few of us ever act on our more principled concerns. Public concern is very fickle. It waxes and wanes with respect to privacy and other sorts of soft ideals. Okay, my job today is to link up the current concern to the particular legal situation we have now in Norway. I'm not going to go into great detail as to what this Data Retention Directive stipulates. My foreign colleagues will do that. But nevertheless, I will have to look briefly at some of the principal aspects of the directive. Otherwise, the discussion about its impact on the current Norwegian legal situation won't make much sense for you. But I'll be focusing for a large part on Norwegian rules. And the current Norwegian rules, as you can see on the slide, are as follows. There are there's a mix of legislation and licensing that is used to regulate when traffic data gets retained and for how long. The basic point of departure is set down by the Electronic Communications Act, Lov om elektronisk kommunikasjon, in paragraph 2.7. And that paragraph says that traffic data are to be deleted once they are no longer necessary for communication or billing purposes. Okay, so deletion once no longer necessary for communication or billing purposes. So the concerns of the police and arguably most of us in society for accessing traffic data in order to counter crime are not explicitly reflected in that particular provision. In addition, traffic data is regarded as personal data, personopplysninger, and thereby fall under the ambit of the Personal Data Act of 2000, personopplysningsloven, which is an act that sets up a number of ground rules for processing of personal data. And under some of those rules, the Data Inspectorate, Datatilsynet, is able to set fairly specific rules for how traffic data are to be used, for how long they are to be stored, etc. And it's done this pursuant to a particular standard license or concession that it's issued for telecommunications service providers, which I term telcos on the slides here. And the rules laid down by the Data Inspectorate pursuant to this licensing scheme are basically reflecting paragraph 2.7 of the Electronic Communications Act. That is, again, data registered for billing purposes shall be deleted when the billing is done or when the deadline for mounting a complaint about the bill you get has passed. The license conditions issued by the Data Inspectorate also have a few elaborations on that point of departure, so that if the telco does quarterly billing, that is billing every 3 months, then you have to delete the traffic data or the billing data at the latest 5 months after the data were initially registered. If you are using a monthly billing scheme, then deletion must occur at the latest 3 months after registration. And if there's a billing dispute, then you can retain the data until that dispute has been settled. Any questions? No. What of the police's ability to access traffic data? Well, the point of departure is again laid down in the Act on Electronic Communications. This is that there is a duty of confidentiality imposed on telcos, on telecommunication service providers, to maintain the confidentiality of data that they are responsible for communicating. Okay. And that's laid down in paragraph 2.9. But that duty is qualified to enable the police to get access to telephone numbers or other subscriber information, including electronic communications addresses, on a when there is a need for the police to get access. And when is there a need for the police to get access? Well, the rules about need are laid down in the Criminal Procedure Act, Strafprozessloven. And there, the basic rule is that the police can require disclosure of traffic data, that's the TD, if there is reasonable ground, Shelley Grun, for suspecting criminal conduct resulting in 5 or more years of imprisonment. In addition, the disclosure has to be of wesentliche Bedeutung, essential significance for the police investigation. Usually also the police have to get prior approval from a magistrate's court. These sorts of rules, I think, are commonplace in Western democracies. It's important to note that the police can't go on what I call general fishing expeditions. They can't approach a telco and say, hey, you know, we've got a vague suspicion that something fishy is going on. Can you give us all the information you've got surrounding that particular incident or sets of incidents or around the particular subscriber? And the fact that the police can't go on general fishing expeditions was confirmed in an interlocutory judgment, a so-called Schenelse, by Norges Høyesterett, the Supreme Court, back in 1999. This was pursuant to the legislation that was in force prior to the current Act on Electronic Communications, and that prior legislation was the Act on Telecommunications from 1995. And again, there was a similar duty of confidentiality included in that act, and the Supreme Court said that despite that duty of confidentiality, the police were still able to ask for the disclosure of the name and telephone number of a subscriber who was storing and disseminating child pornography over the internet. In this case, the police knew the times of when the person was active on the net. They also knew the dynamic IP address. You all know what a dynamic IP address is, at least some of you do. It's the IP address that you would be issued with, or your machine would be issued with, for a particular session on the internet. But once that session is closed, the IP address also falls into disuse. Most of us these days, when we're on the internet, don't have dynamic IP addresses. We're moving increasingly now to a situation where we have consistent IP addresses. But in any case, the police knew the dynamic IP address of the person concerned, and with that information, they were allowed to go to the ISP in question and demand disclosure of the person's name and other identifying and some other identifying information. But as I said, the court majority in that case held that while they could get disclosure in this particular case, the provision on the duty of confidentiality of communications did not allow the police to go on generalised fishing expeditions. Some of you might think that the debate about data retention, or the debate about when one can use billing data generated from the use of telephone services or communication services, is new, that it's something that's only been happening in the last year or so. That's not the case. Back in the early 1990s, there was a fairly big controversy about the so-called Centax system, which is no longer known by that particular name, but it was the system that first introduced specified billing, okay, specificerte regninger, for one's use of the ordinary telephony services. Okay, this is prior to the days when there was mass use of the internet. And Telenor, I can't remember if it was Telenor back in 1992, or if it was Televerket. Anyone remember? Anyway, Telenor or its predecessor wanted to introduce this system to generate more accurate billing of what people did, or of the use that people made of their telephones. And this was this system represented a paradigm shift, perhaps more so than what the current data retention directive signifies. Because it was the first time that one's private communications, or the communications one engaged in from the apparent privacy of one's own home, was going to be actually registered and then disseminated. I think that was a major step. And for that reason, the Centax system and its introduction did occasion fairly significant controversy, which nowadays most people have forgotten about. There was a fairly protracted complaints process where the data inspectorate, Datatilsynet, turned its thumb down to the Centax system. Its decision was appealed to the Ministry of Justice, and the Ministry of Justice overturned the decision of the data inspectorate, thus allowing the Centax system to be introduced. But at the same time, the data inspectorate was able to set down certain rules as to how long the billing data would be retained. And those rules survive now in the current concession, the current license given to telcos. What happened since the early 1990s in the debate over the Centax system up until about a year ago? Well, very little in terms of public debate here in Norway. This is somewhat surprising given the fact that policy moves around data retention or traffic data retention have not been dead. We had back in 2002 a draft framework decision on retention of traffic data, which I think formally speaking was a Belgian proposal. I won't go into the details here because I presume it'll be dealt with by yourself, possibly. That suggested, just briefly, that EU member states would have to retain traffic or have rules requiring the retention of traffic data from a minimum of 12 months up to a maximum of 24 months. That draft framework decision didn't go ahead, and the directive that we're now currently debating is the replacement initiative. Also, the Council of Europe, which is not an EU organisation, the Council of Europe is a different organisation, an intergovernmental organisation, that drafted a cybercrime convention in the late 90s, which was finally adopted in 2001. That also has rules on retention of traffic data. Article 16 is the relevant provision there. It mandates retention of traffic data for up to 90 days. And that retention period can be renewed. But neither of those two initiatives created much controversy here in Norway, or indeed in most European countries. And again, I think that's because, as I said at the start of this lecture, public concern about privacy issues is fickle. It waxes and wanes and depends on whether the sun is shining and what sort of impact it's going to have on one's everyday life. And I think one of the reasons why this directive is starting to gain public attention is because a lot of people are on the internet. A lot of people are accessing content that is probably not content that they would want to be associated with, in the public at least. And there is a misconception, this is my personal view, and I should also stress that I'm talking here personally, I'm not talking at all as a representative of the Personvern Kommission. This is my personal points of view. There is a misconception, I think, amongst many people that what the directive will require is the retention of so-called surfologer, that is, logs over which websites you browse, the URLs of the websites you browse. In fact, that's not the case. The directive leaves open to member states whether they want to do that or not. My understanding is that the Norwegian working group that has been working on how to implement this directive now for quite a while is not going to propose that the Norwegian implementation result in mandatory retention of surfologer, of the URLs of the websites you visit. If you do open for that sort of retention, then you're getting dangerously near retention of not so much traffic data, but retention of the actual contents of communication. But there are some other reasons, I think, why the data retention directive is controversial, and deservedly so. It's quite clear that it does introduce some significant new elements to the current Norwegian regulatory situation. And I say this despite the claims made by the Ministry of Justice here and certain persons in the police forces that, hey, you know, the data retention directive is just continuing on the status quo. It's not. It's not. There are some significant new elements that will be introduced. In the first place, and these are some examples, the data retention directive will require storage of geolocalization data. Okay. The data that is generated by your mobile phone. It will require storage of email logs, that is, the email that you send, not the contents of the email, but when you send the email, from which IP address you're sending the email, to whom you're sending the email. It will require storage of internet connection and disconnection times. And again, as I said, IP addresses used. more organizations are going to be affected by the storage requirements. We're probably going to have a situation where there will be longer storage time, but how much longer, we still don't know. As Dag said, the minimum storage time is 6 months, the maximum is 24 months. My hope is that the Norwegian implementation will go for the minimum period, 6 months, but I wouldn't be surprised if one ends up with a 12-month storage period. Also important is that the directive will probably result in the introduction of a different normative platform for data retention. There will be a duty to retain traffic data, whereas, as I said at the start of this lecture, the point of departure now is traffic data is to be deleted once no longer necessary for billing or communication purposes. So it's a quite different normative point of departure. The Data Inspectorate, Datatilsynet, has on several occasions come out publicly and said that this directive entails mass surveillance, storskala overvåking, and the like. It makes us all suspects and reverses the traditional onus of proof, whereby one is to begin with innocent until otherwise proven guilty. I don't buy all of that particular line. It depends, of course, on how you define overwalking or surveillance, but the Data Retention Directive and its implementation will not necessarily involve continuous monitoring of people's communications. Okay, it's not going to lead to a situation where there will be police agencies looking over your shoulder, in effect, over what you do on the net. That's not the case. It will involve rather a storage of data which the police can then access on a case-by-case basis. But even if we don't buy the line that the Data Retention Directive opens up for mass surveillance, there are still, I think, some significant and legitimate concerns. One concern is the fact that organizations generally tend often to have rather poor security cultures. They don't take care of the personal data they have stored. Some of you might remember the scandalous incident in the UK not that long ago where some computer disks with the data on some 25 million UK citizens went missing in the post. Just amazing. But this is not extraordinary. I mean, it is rather extraordinary, that particular situation, but there are numerous incidents showing that organizations don't take care, don't have the necessary security measures in place. And here in Norway, we have some concrete examples of telcos not taking care of their customer data. And the directive and its implementation will lead to more telcos, ISPs and the like, storing traffic data for longer periods, and that will mean that their security structures will be even more vulnerable to leakage. At the same time, it's quite clear that the concerns of the police and arguably us as citizens of a society that wants to uphold the rule of law and fight crime, those concerns are also legitimate. The police have very legitimate concerns with the shift in billing structures from a pay-per-session platform to a flat fee pricing structure where you pay per month and you can use your mobile or the internet or whatever for as much as you want. You just pay a flat fee. And it's quite clear then that from a commercial point of view, there is no need to store traffic data for billing purposes. You're getting billed at a certain rate no matter what you do. And that's a legitimate concern. Are those data just then going to be automatically deleted under the present regulatory framework because they are not necessary for billing purposes? It will cut the police off from data that has the potential to help clear up serious crime. There's also a possible, what I term, free state problem. That is, if Norway alone amongst the EU EEA member states decides not to implement the directive, will it then entice criminal actors to come and engage in their communication with Norway as a base? I don't know how realistic how great the potential is of this sort of free state problem, but it does have a potential. It is a concern. But I think the ultimate challenge for the police at the moment, at least in terms of getting public opinion on their side, is to be able to document publicly the need for access to these data and the need for storage of these data. Okay, as Doug mentioned, we have some examples being trotted out, the NORCOS case where David Tosca was able to be apprehended partly through analysis of traffic data. You'll recall he was communicating from an internet cafe down in Spain with mates back here in Norway, and arguably without that access to the traffic data, the police would have found it difficult to be able to localise where he was communicating from. There are a few other cases, but the police, I think, still have a job to do in terms of getting out to the public clear, solid evidence of the significance of data retention for countering and clearing up crime. Okay, quickly over to the future impact and status of the directive. I'm just doing this quickly because these points will no doubt be dealt with in more detail later. First of all, you know, the directive is in some significant ways difficult to understand. And this is particularly the case with the provisions dealing with storage of internet-related data. At the same time, the EU member states have been given a considerable margin for manoeuvre in implementation. As Doug said, the storage time can be anywhere from 6 months to 24 months. The notion of serious crime is not defined. Also, the list of what can be stored or what must be stored is not exhaustive in the sense that my understanding anyway is that member states are not precluded from also requiring storage of other types of data. The directive just lays out a minimum list of data to be stored. So there's considerable margin for manoeuvre, which does mean that it's unlikely that we're going to get harmonised storage periods across Europe. There's a big question mark at the moment hanging over the directive's legality. The problem is that the directive is a so-called first pillar instrument. That is, it's an instrument that is established as an internal market regulatory instrument. It's not established as a third pillar instrument, as an instrument dealing with police cooperation. And yet, arguably, that's what the directive is all about, isn't it? It's about combating crime. And indeed, that draft framework decision I mentioned earlier, that was a third pillar instrument. But now we have a directive, which is a first pillar instrument. So the question arises, is the directive ultra vires? And as will no doubt be elaborated on a little bit later, Ireland has sued the Commission and the Council arguing that the directive doesn't have the right legal legs. My own opinion is that Ireland has a good chance of success. My opinion is based partly on a decision of the European Court of Justice handed down in 2006, which struck down a particular agreement between the EU and the USA for the transfer of airline passenger data to US authorities. That agreement was also set up as a first pillar agreement, but the court said, this has nothing to do with the internal market. This is all about crime and judicial cooperation. It's a third pillar instrument, and you can't set up have a third pillar instrument parading as a first pillar instrument. Go back and do your homework. That's what the ECJ was effectively saying. And I think there's a good chance that the same result will occur with the Ireland case. And that also then raises questions as to the directive's place in the EEA agreement, or EOS of Thailand, which is a first pillar internal market scheme. If the directive is in fact properly to be regarded as a third pillar instrument, then it has no real place as part of the, as an appendix to the to EOS of Thailand. That doesn't mean that Norway won't then implement the directive. It may in fact end up changing the regulatory framework independently of any directive or otherwise. It may end up implementing, if the directive is given new legal legs, it may end up implementing that in any case, separate to the EA agreement. There's also been a bit of discussion, particularly amongst parliamentarians here, as to whether Norway should exercise its veto power under the EEA agreement. Certainly, that's a possibility, but I don't see that really happening because of the longer-term political consequences of exercising that power. Okay, well, that brings me to the end of what I had to say.